So they brought in some of the lovely ladies who worked at this research center, middle-aged New Jersey ladies, and they said, now, when you saw that picket line, how did you feel? And they said, afraid. One element of the crime proven. As I say, it's thought crime. They never rescued an animal, and these young people, four or five of them, are doing approximately, I think, 10 or 12 years each just for threatening, just for saying it, just for putting it on a website that animals shouldn't be tortured in experimental labs. Now, it may not be your favorite topic. I know I've been asked, and I say, and perhaps I'll make people mad at me here, you know, I always figure let's take care of people first, and the animals will be taken care of automatically. But I just think that we have to be very clear on what the government thinks is important and what they are going after. And how many people here even know there is another trial starting, I believe it started last week in Seattle, another Friends of the Earth case in which a young woman is accused by two informants of being a lookout during a million-dollar fire. Both of these informants are so questionable. Their testimony totally contradicts each other, and yet they are the witnesses and the only witnesses against this young woman. And this case is being tried in Seattle, Washington. We don't even know about it, but it's another one where the government is intent upon getting a conviction and sending these folks to jail for very, very many years. I think this young woman faces 20 or 30 years in federal prison if convicted. And of course, we know about the periodic, specious roundups of Muslims. By that I mean the cases such as the one in Miami, where a group of young men, obviously poor, because we know they must be poor because they live in some place called Liberty City. You know, only poor people would live in a place called Liberty City, and who were accused of a plot to blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago. Well, it turned out that the plot was really the informant's plot, and these guys were just trying to hustle this guy for a few bucks for boots and whatever they could get out of him. That case was tried, and it went to a hung jury with one person being completely acquitted. But what did they do? Did they say, you know, maybe this case is a bridge too far? You know, we're not supposed to really guess about whether or not a crime might be committed. We have to wait until there's a little more evidence of crime. Did the government say that? Mm-mm. They said, let's go, we'll try it again. This time we'll get it right. And they are on trial right now for the second time in 6 months. Samuel Arian, which Professor Finkelstein mentioned, you know, Sammy is not one of my favorite defendants, and I have to say he's not one of my favorite defendants only because when he was convicted, when he was acquitted, rather, in Tampa, which was a tremendous victory, he went on and on about how this was a great country and the jury system really works, and he always knew he would be acquitted and so on and so forth, which is not exactly fair to those of us who have all our lives fought to make the system honest, to make the system be a real justice system and not just a thing that they throw as a sop to poor people to get them to think there's some hope for justice. But even notwithstanding that, Sammy by now has really learned how just the justice system is, because after he copped a plea to the last remaining charges against him, he was ready to be deported back to, I believe he was going to Jordan, that was the agreement. It might have been to Palestine, I'm not sure, but he was going to be deported. When all of a sudden, in contravention of the agreement with the government, and this is the same government, he served with a subpoena to a grand jury. A grand jury sitting in that most pernicious of spots, Eastern Virginia, which is pure Bush country, Ashcroft country, Gonzales country. Every judge there is handpicked, every U.S. attorney. And so Sammy appears before the judge. He said, but I was guaranteed no further prosecution. Oh, this is a separate prosecution. This is not the same prosecution. This is a separate prosecution. We need your evidence. Now, if you don't know it, if you refuse to talk to a grand jury, you can be subject to contempt, and there is no fixed sentence. It's whatever the judge wants to give you. And if you talk to a grand jury and they decide you lied on some fact or non-fact or controverted fact, then you will be indicted for perjury and go to jail. So Sammy's victory, on the one hand, quickly turned to ashes. And I can say for my case, I have been very lucky that I had encouragement from so many people to keep on keeping on. That is, keep on speaking out, keep on traveling. And when I got to places like Minnesota and Milwaukee and Birmingham, Alabama, and found the political people there and that they were for real and that they supported me and that they supported doing away with the Patriot Act, all of they were very, very aware of the inroads on American freedom, and they wanted to do something about it. Problem is, we haven't given them a place to go at this point. The movement is moribund at this point. We don't have a movement as such. So people that are feeling this unease, that are saying, I really want to do something, but what can I do? The little woman in Seattle who said to me, you know, I'm afraid to do anything. Tell me what to do. And I said, well, you have to fight back. You can say to yourself you're afraid, but you'll be less afraid if you're fighting back. You'll meet other people that fight back. But I just want to suggest to you that there are, I agree with Michael, it's, the change is not going to come from the Democratic or the Republican Party. But I'd like to suggest to you, maybe we ought to think about third parties. You know, that's a historic background for America. Robert La Follette, even I can remember as a young person, my father being so impressed by Wayne Morse. He was an independent senator, and he wouldn't sit on the Republican or on the Democratic side. He sat in the aisle. And I know for me personally, I'm not here to give plugs, but it's refreshing to have someone like a Cynthia McKinney, someone who really expresses what I think about things, someone who has always stood up. I also would like to say that I think we ought to think about attacking them where they're most vulnerable, and I think they're most vulnerable on this war in Iraq. Everybody hates this war. Even the people who are not, you know, old-time Vietnam War nicks, they're embarrassed at the terrible betrayal that this war is, at the how many $32 million that was packed up, that was taken off a plane by one of those forklifts, and disappeared. Makes us look so stupid, doesn't it? At the use of people from Blackwater, at the use of these mercenaries, at the how our young people who are over there supposedly fighting for America have become totally immoral. Abu Ghraib, it was interesting, I was debating a real neocon the other day, and he said, oh, Abu Ghraib, it just was like a big fraternity party. And I said to him, now I know why I always hated fraternities. And I'm probably insulting 50 people in this room, but anyway. I do know that silence is not the answer. It is our moral indignation. And we have to, for ourselves, constantly be political. Talk politics. You know, we come to a meeting like this, oh, we're all political. Then tomorrow we may go see our friends and go to the movies, and suddenly there's not a political word in our mouths. We have to be political in all the spheres we operate in. And I think you will find that there are a lot of people who do want to talk politics, because a lot of people don't know where to go and what to do. Thank you very much.
Lynn Stewart, former criminal defense lawyer whose career focused on defending unpopular political cases. You're listening to excerpts from the Freedoms at Risk conference held at NYU in New York City last February. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.
I would now like to welcome to the podium Professor Mark Crispin Miller.
I don't want to talk from the left. I don't want to talk as a leftist. I want to talk, I think Norman will appreciate this, more as an empiricist. I mean, I think one of the things that we learn to do, we should learn to do in the university, is to think clearly and argue on the basis of evidence, use facts whenever possible. I don't know how to break this to you, but the situation is, in one sense, worse than you've been given to understand so far. It's actually worse. And now I'm going to give you the bright side in a moment, but just indulge me right now when I say it's actually worse, because the third party is not an option at the moment for two reasons. One is that our election system is absolutely corrupt, okay? So that if Jesus Christ were to run on a third-party ticket, he would only serve to help the Republicans steal the election, okay? Or Karl Marx. Scratch Jesus. Say Karl Marx were to run, it wouldn't make any difference. And second of all, we don't have proportional representation. Now, Ralph Nader is a friend of mine. I worked for him. I actually brought him here in 2000. So that those are my bona fides. So they didn't think I'm some kind of, you know, stealth Democrat. I'm not a complete independent. But Ralph's bid in 2004 was heavily dependent, he didn't know this, on the Republican Party, which fought to put him on the ballot all over the country. Let me make this clear, not to take votes away from the Democrats, not to do that, because the Republicans don't really care how people vote, you see? Moreover, it isn't the case that they use fear to get people to vote for them. They don't do that because they don't care about that. What they want to do, and this is a fine distinction, but a very important one, what they want to do is come up with a rationale, a convincing rationale that will help explain their surprise victory. So the utility of using, say, the terror card is not that it will actually get people to vote for them because they're scared. The utility of the terror card is that when the Republicans win, despite the fact that they were behind in the polls and all the exit polls said that they actually lost, and I could go on and on. When that happens, the press will say, oh, yeah, it was the fear of terrorism. That's what did it. Now, the problem here is not just political, but it's epistemological and psychological. By that I mean we have a hard time knowing what's really going on, because the official narrative is far more persuasive than we even realize. For example, I'm sure that many people in here tonight assume that we are vastly outnumbered by a huge, sluggish, apathetic population of fearful, dim bulbs who voted for Bush, you know, because they were scared in 2004, or because they're very right-wing, very religious. Here's the good news that I have for you. The good news is that this government has never been elected. Never been elected. Okay? Would you just let that sink in for a moment? This president has never been elected, nor is there any evidence that he was ever elected. I overstate. The official numbers are a kind of evidence that he was elected, okay? Other than that, there's no evidence that he was ever elected. Moreover, there is copious evidence that the Senate has been disproportionately peopled by politicians who didn't get there because the people in their state voted for them, okay? Now, let me give you the official narrative of where we are today. And then let me explain how it's all false. Now, the point I'm here to address is a double one, it's a dual point. One is that the election system is completely corrupt. And I want to end by explaining why that does matter, okay? And secondly, and very closely related to that, is the fact that the media system is completely corrupt, okay? It has nothing to do with us, okay? The official narrative is that the country was very evenly divided in 2000. Bush squeaked by in Florida because of Ralph Nader. This is the official narrative now, right? Ralph Nader stole some votes from Al Gore. I mean, he didn't deserve to have them himself. He stole them from Gore. There was a long and agonizing sort of political struggle on the ground for 36 days, and the Republicans managed to win that battle. And, of course, Bush ultimately won, right? Bush ultimately won. He won in Florida. So, you know, oh yeah, the Supreme Court stopped the vote. That was unfortunate. And the decision, Bush v. Gore, is a little oddly reasoned, perhaps. It's too bad. But you know, Bush did win. Okay? Then in 2002, which doesn't get as much press because it's an off-year election, in 2002, you may remember Jim Jeffords of Vermont had left the Republican Party because it was too right-wing for him. Remember this? And the Republicans lost control of the Senate. This was in the spring of 2002. So in the fall, there was this surprise series, a spate, I should call them, of Republican victories in Colorado and in Georgia and in New Hampshire and in Minnesota. And, of course, the architect of all this was the brilliant Karl Rove, the mastermind of these come-from-behind victories. They did a brilliant job getting out the vote and so on. So they took the Senate, okay? And the press hailed Karl Rove as a genius. The cover of Time magazine was, Bush and Rove ace their midterms, okay? 2004, Bush won by 11.5 million more votes than he'd received in 2002. Why did he win? The religious right, right? These Christians came forth in multitudes, right? They just materialized at the very end of the day, remember? And Bush was reelected, handily, over John Kerry. Then in 2006, it was demonstrated to us all that the system actually does work because the Democrats won all those House seats. So if anybody had any idea that there was fraud involved, the victory in 2006 should put paid to that. Clearly, Bush got a thumping, as he put it. And now we're engaged in this really, really dramatic, exciting nail-biter of a horse race between a woman, which is a historic first, and a black man, which is another historic first. And the young people are galvanized by Obama. And John McCain has done incredibly well, and so on, and here we are, okay? Now, every single thing that I just said is false. Uneasy laughter. Every single thing that I, and by the way, the specifics I give you, I urge you to go home and Google them, do whatever you have to do to see if I'm telling you the truth, because I could indeed be abusing my position and propagandizing and so on, making stuff up. Let's start with the present, okay, let's just get a sense of where we are right now. How many of you have heard about what happened in New Hampshire between Obama and Clinton? How many? I know you've all heard that she won, but how many of you have heard about some of the oddities of the vote? How many? I probably know all seven of you, right? Well, you know, 84% of the votes in New Hampshire counted by computerized machines, by optical scanners. Okay, the other 15 or so percent are counted by hand. Hillary Clinton won the machine-counted vote by 4.3%. Barack Obama won the hand-counted vote by 6.1%. Isn't that peculiar? Now, this is completely inexplicable. The press immediately came up with explanations for it. Demographic explanations, saying, for example, well, there were a lot of racists in New Hampshire, and they didn't want to tell pollsters the truth about the fact that they don't want to vote for a black man. This immediately came out of the mouths of pundits, based on no research, based on no study. And indeed, it turns out that Obama won essentially the north half of the state, which is the rural half. So that theory holds, you know, no water at all. Other theories came out. Okay, then a lonely radio reporter in Connecticut decided to do some research. She called a number of town clerks in New Hampshire, okay, to ask if anything peculiar had happened the few days prior to the election. One small private company, it's called LHS Programming, one small private company programs all the voting machines in New England. In the last few days before Election Day, employees of LHS dropped in to see the town clerks all over New Hampshire and made changes in the memory cards in those machines. This is noteworthy, don't you think? This suggests that something was wrong, that the machines were fixed in New Hampshire. And once we understand the relationship between the Republican Party and the manufacturers of these machines, we realize that it looks quite likely that the Republicans, in this case, fixed the machines in New Hampshire, as they have done before, in order to put Hillary on top, because Hillary's the one they most want to run against. Okay? Now, that's one part of the equation, the machines. Over 80% of the vote in this country is counted by computerized machines. And the four companies that make those machines all have close ties to the Republican Party. Now, there's always been election fraud. But we have never before in our history had a situation like this one, in which one or two operatives in under a minute can manipulate the machinery to change the vote count by millions. So what I'm suggesting to you is that we really cannot look at the results of our elections and on that basis make confident inferences about where the people stand. Now, in New York, let me ask, how many of you voted in the New York primary? Not that many, okay. Do you know that in 78 districts around the city, Obama got zero votes, including districts in Harlem? How many of you knew this? Okay, a few more knew this. This was the subject of a piece in the New York Times. And the other day, Mayor Bloomberg was quoted in the New York Post, which is pretty amazing, as saying this looked like election fraud. Now, this, you know, has gone nowhere. But the New York Times reported this much difficulty encountered by would-be voters for Obama. If you keep your ear to the ground, you realize that would-be voters for Obama encountered precisely this kind of difficulty, were unable to vote, all over California, all over New Mexico, all over Arizona. And it also, it turns out, that the Clinton campaign engaged in massive vote suppression and has been doing so throughout this primary season. Now, election fraud means manipulating the machines in order to change the vote count. Vote suppression is a much more old-fashioned, Jim Crow kind of activity. It means giving people disinformation about where their polling places are. It means closing polling places early. Bill Clinton was personally inside of caucus rooms in Nevada intimidating people who were voting for Obama. How many of you heard this? Okay, the numbers keep dwindling. So, you know, the fact of the matter is the election system, our election system, doesn't function at all, really. And equally troublingly, we know almost nothing about what's been happening to people who try to vote since 2000. Now, let me talk a little bit about why I actually think this is important. I've already said that a third-party movement will simply function to the benefit of the party that wants to manipulate that third party. This is not the case at the local level. In local races, the Green Party has done tremendous things. It has actually managed to win victories and make progressive changes at the grassroots. But when it comes to national elections, third-party movements until we have proportional representation and a trustworthy voting system are not going to be helpful, because they will end up being used to help explain why, say, John McCain won. Cynthia McKinney probably will be nominated as the Green Party candidate, and she will undoubtedly get a lot of help from the GOP. And if and when McCain wins the election, which at the moment, you know, seems extremely unlikely, I promise you Cynthia McKinney's candidacy will be trotted out as a reason why this happened. But also, the notion of taking to the streets as in and of itself a solution, a political solution, is insufficient. We have taken to the streets. One of the biggest marches we've ever seen in this country's history took place around the time of the Iraq War. The press basically ignores it. Moreover, and here's another case where the situation is actually worse than we think, our military is now built to punish gatherings of people in the streets to an unprecedented extent. They have developed extremely expensive technologies whose purpose is to make any kind of forbidden assembly extremely painful. You know, they have microwaves that can be used to give you a sensation of acute and agonizing burning all over your whole body. If you want to see how taking to the streets can work, okay, check out what happened with the demonstration against free trade in Miami a couple years ago. The police chief of Miami used $8 million that came directly out of the disbursement for the Iraq War. There were literally tanks in the streets there. The turnout was very much diminished because Secret Service agents and others were visiting organizers of the protest in their homes beforehand, and a lot of people were intimidated into staying home. You talk to Naomi Klein, people like that, you ask her what went down there, and she'll tell you that the crowd was pretty small. And they were small because people were scared. And the police there showed them no mercy. Now, the point is this, okay? Democracy. We've been taught to believe, I think wrongly, that voting is the only democratic activity that's legitimate. I mean, there's a kind of propaganda of voting that we've been indoctrinated with, you know, throughout our years in school. Actually, democracy entails a whole range of activities, of which protest is one, and an important one. There's also lobbying. There's also lawsuits. There's all kinds of things that people can and should do to be politically engaged. So voting is not the only one. But without the right to vote, and here I'm paraphrasing Tom Paine, without the right to vote, however unsatisfying the range of candidates, and believe me, I don't think anyone in here can touch me in my contempt for the range of candidates who are running now, okay? If one doesn't have the right to vote, if we don't have the power to vote our representatives in and out of office, we have no political freedoms at all. We have none. One of the reasons why the Bush regime is so stunningly brazen in its violations of the law, and you've heard Lynn and Michael talk about this, they're absolutely right. I mean, we've never had a presidency as explicitly, as flamboyantly fascistic as this one. We've never had a president as openly contemptuous of public opinion as this one. We've never had a president and a vice president who basically do this all the time. And there's a very simple reason for this. It's that they have absolutely no fear of any electoral consequences. Now, I think that the relationship of voting to democracy is comparable to the relationship of breathing to life. You know, if you can only breathe, if all you can do is breathe, you're not really living. That's not a life. You're just sort of subsisting, you exist. But if you can't breathe, you're dead. What has happened here is that the Bush team has devoted itself to the subversion of democracy on every conceivable level. We like to say that they're incompetent, that their handling of the Iraq War is incompetence, that their handling of Katrina is an example of incompetence. I don't think it's incompetence. I think that what went wrong was fine with them. To call them incompetent presumes that they have the same aims and concerns that the rest of us do. They don't. But when it comes to the subversion of democracy, believe me, they are peerless. They have devoted themselves to this kind of thing for years. This is basically what they're all about. Even as we speak, the Department of Justice, okay, is now engaged in limiting the franchise as vigorously as it once was engaged in defending people's rights to vote. The Department of Justice has been making it all but illegal to conduct voter registration drives. They're carrying out legal voter purges around the country. They're doing this very quietly. For the last 3 to 5 years, they have really taken on no cases of people's voting rights being violated. They've mainly concerned themselves with cases of what they call religious freedom, you know, which means the freedom to be a Christianist and use the public square to do so. This is our Department of Justice. Our Supreme Court has consistently, in case after case, acted against the franchise, against the will of the electorate. They are clearly inclined to uphold the voter ID law in Indiana. Do you all know about this? Indiana has the strictest voter ID law in the country. This means that voters have to produce state-issued ID in order to vote. If they can't produce such an ID, they have something like 15 days to go to travel to the county seat in order to have their ballot counted. This is a hardship for poor people. They can't easily get hold of a state-issued ID. It actually costs some money to get one. John Roberts and Antonin Scalia, when they heard arguments about this last month, were openly contemptuous of the idea that anyone would have a hard time getting a voter ID. This is the strictest such law in the country. There are 8 other laws like it. They made abundantly clear in their argument that they're probably going to uphold this law. That means the other laws like it in the country will stand, and it also may well mean that Republican-dominated legislatures all around the country will pass similar laws. Okay? This is just one tiny little sector of a very broad front on which the Bush Republicans are really doing everything they can to prevent people from voting. Now, as I said, they use the machines to misrepresent the vote, to throw votes away, and so on. They have flipped votes all over the country. All over the country, people would push the button for Kerry in 2004, and the light for Bush would go on. Okay? Now, this is not to suggest in any way that the Democrats would do something about this. Okay? I'm not suggesting that. Let me tell you an amazing story. In 2006, as I said, the story is the Democrats did incredibly well. They took 29 House seats. They were popping the champagne corks. Rahm Emanuel and our old Charles Schumer were being feted, F-E-T-E-D, lionized for having